Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
In this week's podcast, we'll discuss how well poetry travels. In particular, how well it weathers the journey across the Atlantic. We'll look at the influence of the great American novelists, and we'll return to these shores for an interview with that most English of writers, Rose Tremain. First, though, a poem from the American poet Billy Collins.
Another reason why I don't keep a gun in the house. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. He's barking the same high rhythmic bark that he barks every time they leave the house. They must switch him on their way out. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. I close all the windows in the house and put on a Beethoven symphony full blast, but I can still hear him muffled under the music, barking, barking, barking. And now I can see him sitting in the orchestra, his head raised confidently, as if Beethoven had included a part for barking dog. When the record finally ends, he's still barking, sitting there in the oboe section, barking, his eyes fixed on the conductor who is entreating him with his baton, while the other musicians listen in respectful silence to the famous barking dog solo, that endless coda that first established Beethoven as an innovative genius.
I Know the Reason Why I Don't Keep a Dog in the House by Billy Collins. Now, Collins is that rarity, the best-selling poet. He's sold more than 200,000 books since his first collection, Poker Face, which was published in 1971. He was appointed the American Poet Laureate in 2001. John Updike, no less, wrote of him, "Billy Collins writes lovely poems, limpid, gently, and consistently startling, more serious than they seem. They describe all the worlds that are and were, and some others beside." With me to discuss issues raised by his work are Anne-Marie Fife, who is herself a poet and runs Coffee House Poetry, a fortnightly poetry evening at the Troubadour in West London, D.D. Guttenplan, London correspondent of The Nation, and Sarah Crown, editor of our own Guardian Books website. Welcome all of you. Anne-Marie, the subject of this particular podcast, How Well Poetry Travels, came out of a debate that you had at the Troubadour, which looked at the popularity of English poetry in the US and vice versa, and posed the question, are we divided by a common poetic language? Well, are we?
Well, I'll start just a little earlier than that, because the idea came from our Troubadour poetry competition, our annual competition, in which for the first time Poetry Foundation in Chicago put out what they call an e-blast, and we suddenly got a huge number of American entries. And one poet said that they would send their poems to support us, but felt that the judges would probably be too English for the taste of American poetry. And we had 23 winners, first, second and third, and 20 commendeds, and no American won a prize, even though there were some well-known names in there. But two Americans who live in this country won a prize. And when I spoke to them, they said they'd modified their subject matter, their syntax, they'd adjusted the ear, because they knew if they wrote like Americans here, they wouldn't win prizes.
Who were they? Who are the two writers, out of interest?
Catherine Maris and Tom Lowenstein.
Was this a surprise to you, or is it something you've always
known?
It
was a huge surprise to me, particularly when I had seen some of the poems that had kind of gone through. So I decided to get two Americans and two UK poets and people in some positions of poetry on both sides of the Atlantic who knew about the poetry world to discuss this at the Troubadour. So I had Alan Jenkins from the TLS, deputy editor, and has been poetry editor twice. Roddy Lumsden, who works on anthologies and workshop groups in this country. I had Molly Peacock, a Canadian American, who's very much published in the States. And I had Carrie Etter, an American, who's teaching at Bath Spa University. Molly Peacock made some interesting points. She described the American scene as being like a bell, that the language and new formalism was all in the centre and the extremes went out to either side. That's the language.
Like and a bell that you
a
toll.
Bell, a bell that you toll, yes. She also likened it to a great American divorce. She said that the next generation of poets didn't want their poetic parents warring and continuing the argument, and that this new formalism and language, which died out, started to die out in the 80s, but took some time to die out fully, and is now really, we've got terms like post-division, radical middle, I mean, how can the middle be radical? So it's all a bit fudgy at the moment as to what the state of things are.
Don, as an American living in the UK, what do you think of this term, the Great American Divorce?
Well, I don't think that you can actually pigeonhole most American poets into either language or new formalism. I mean, as somebody who gave up writing poetry after he succeeded in convincing Kenneth Koch that I could never write decent poetry. He tried to teach me when I was in college, and so I've restricted myself to prose for the last 30 years. But perhaps as a hangover of that experience, I still read poetry for pleasure, and I buy books of poetry, and I love reading poetry. And when I tend to go on holiday, I tend to take a couple of books of poetry in my luggage along with the novels that I like to take. And I think that, you know, the American poetry scene is much broader than that. I assume that what Molly Peacock, a poet who I have read with great pleasure, meant is that, you know, it's a standard Bell distribution, that most of it's sort of in the middle rather than either at this pole or at that pole.
But wouldn't you say that Wallace Stevens is in one side and Robert Frost is in the other?
No, I wouldn't. And I wouldn't say, where would you put John Ashbery? Where would you put...
Well, John Ashbery is the avant-garde,
he's not
the
a new
abstract.
Formalist. I mean, he's, you know, he's John Ashbery.
No, he's not a new formalist. That's exactly
right.
The point.
And you know, the people who were responding to him, I mean, I think that there's a kind of... I mean, if what you're saying is that poetry travels from Britain to America, but not from America to Britain mostly.
I don't think it travelled very well in either direction.
See, that I'm sure you're wrong about. I hate to say that, but I'm sure you're wrong. If you look at a poetry section in a decent American bookstore, you'll see Don Patterson, Simon Armitage, Carol Ann Duffy, Robin Robertson, all with big, we're talking about Knopf, Frost, Strauss, Norton.
Yes,
these are big commercial houses.
You certainly see the poets who have agents in American bookstores, but you won't see something totally represented.
I have to say that I don't think any of them are getting rich. They just have big publishers. I mean, I once did a piece way back 30 years ago about who could make a living as a poet. And at that time, the only poets that actually made a living entirely from poetry were Allen Ginsberg and Rod McEwen.
Right. Now, this brings us to another point, which is the difference is in the terms of production, really, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, in America, you make the point, Anne.
Well, in America, most poets are teachers, and they teach in the universities. The poet Tom Slay said to me, when poets meet in America, they say to each other, where do you teach? They don't say, what do you do? So you don't have Robert Burns as excise officer, or Les Murray, farmer, or Wallace Stevens, insurance. Whatever, they teach in the universities.
And this has an effect on the craft?
Well, the magazines are produced from the universities. You can send poems one semester, two at most. The readings take place in the universities, not like here in back rooms or basements. So you could say in one sense, they're paid, they're salaried, and there's a huge number of jobs come out of that. But who then are poets writing for? Does a university require a certain standard of poem to be published in these magazines? It's said that the American public do not read poetry, that poets write for each other.
Sarah, is that very different to the situation over here? I always thought that the British public didn't read poets either.
I think this is actually probably a truth that is applicable on both sides of the Atlantic. We're told again and again, nobody reads poetry, nobody buys poetry, nobody's interested in poetry. And my experience as editor of the Guardian's books website is that this is absolutely not the case. Whenever we have anything online about poetry, it will be the most popular thing that day. We have a weekly poetry blog from Carol Rumens where she deconstructs a poem. It's called Poem of the Week. And it is always the most commented on, the most discussed, the most sort of thought-provoking in terms of the thoughts of our audience, article of the week. It's frustrating to me that people will insist on this idea that poetry isn't read. It may be that it's not bought, but then, you know, books, literary fiction isn't really bought if you want to get down to actual numbers.
And Don, is this the same in the States?
Well, I don't understand what you think British poets are living on. Are they living on air? I mean, how do they support themselves?
Well, I mean, that...
They either have jobs in the academy, like American poets. You have the same... You are lumbered with or blessed with, depending on your view of these things, the same creative writing industry that we have, where people produce things in order to get credentials to train people to produce things. But, you know,
It's certainly true. We are becoming more American. You look at the pages of the London Review books and you see every MA course now with a lot of our well-known poets teaching on these courses.
It's also ridiculous to say that poetry here is this thing that flourishes in gritty, authentic backroom basements. I mean, they have poetry slams, you know, on the Lower East Side. They've been having them, you know, for the last 25 years. You know, there's a whole poetry scene in America, just as I'm sure there is here. And, you know, on the other hand, it's true that, I mean, here are three statistics which don't all add up to the same thing, so make of them what you will. On the one hand, more people write poetry in America than read it.
That's certainly the same here.
Yes.
Poetry Magazine has 30,000 subscribers to the print edition. Secondly, they get more than 30,000 submissions every year, or more than 30,000 different people send them poems every year. And their online presence gets millions of views. So, you know, people in America read poetry, not the American version of The Man in the Clapham Omnibus. The man on the number two train may not be carrying a thin book of Frank O'Hara, although I often used to when I was on the number two train.
Let's talk about Billy Collins. He's not entirely rated, is he? He's not entirely kosher.
Well, in certain poet circles, he would be regarded as too accessible and too easy and too populist and sells too many books. And there would be a certain snobbery around that he should be, writing tougher stuff. And yet he is an enormously successful poet on both sides of the Atlantic.
So that's similar to somebody like Simon Armitage for us,
yeah.
Sarah?
Paul Durkin, I was thinking of, as a similar style of poet who writes extremely accessible poems. I think Simon Armitage is actually maybe a bit more complicated.
Yeah. Caroline Duffy?
Caroline Duffy, perhaps. She's yeah, Caroline Duffy is a very good example.
People love to read her, maybe not, and yet.
And she writes, poems about love.
They are accessible poets. And then you have our more avant-garde side, like Lee Harwood, Richard Price, Robert Potts and David Hurd when they had poetry review.
Now, because you mentioned J.H. Prynne, it reminded me of something. There's two things that I think separate Britain and America. One is there are certain British poets and readers who are still tone-deaf to, and you know, fair enough, Whitman and Williams and all the poets that are influenced by them. I think the other thing is that because of Eliot, and not the British Eliot, if you like, but the French Eliot, the Eliot who was influenced by Reverdy, we have a whole sort of avant-garde that looked to France that we had, you know, from Ashbery forward. And I think that, except for Jeremy Prynne, who was very big when I was an undergraduate, but I think nowadays you'd have to call him a sort of a dead end. That didn't happen the same way here.
I think that we're going to leave that discussion now. There's plenty there to chew on, and I hope we'll be able to come back to it in later podcasts. I wonder if you can each give one poet that we should be reading that we may not know about, one American poet.
Stephen Dunn.
Sarah.
I'd say my favourite contemporary American poet is probably Frederick Seidel. He's an interesting case because he's a New Yorker, but he's almost international in his sensibility, I think. And he writes beautifully about America, but not the sort of mountains and wide open plains of America and that sort of rarefied nature America that lots of poets seem to have retreated into over there. He has a much more novelistic sensibility
and
more than America.
Marie Ponceau.
You want to say one word, one line?
I just think she's amazing, and if you haven't read her, you're in for a great treat.
Whatever the issues facing poetry, fiction is surely international. Sarah, you recently interviewed E.L. Doctorow, I believe, and you came back looking very starstruck indeed.
Yes, I am a huge fan of his. I think he's probably one of the finest, most flexible, most fascinating authors of the 20th century, and he's still writing brilliantly now, for which we should all be thankful. I think, for me, that he's up there with Roth and Updike and Bellow in terms of his ability. And I think probably the reason why he's not perhaps quite as well known as those three are is that he's more versatile. He disappears into his work in a way that they don't quite necessarily. And he's written everything from a Civil War epic, The March, to the sort of semi-autobiographical book World's Fair, based around his own childhood to an extent. So he's covered everything in the last century, the American century, and I think he's just astounding.
But, Don, we don't see him mentioned in the same breath as Bellow and Roth.
Well, I love it, E.L. Doctorow, and a couple of years ago I reviewed a collection of his in the TLS and began by saying that he's like the Rodney Dangerfield of American fiction because he gets no respect. He's not rated in that category in America either, although I agree with you, he should be.
Just before Christmas, we carried a piece by Mark Lawson, who has just done an 8-part series on Radio 4 about the American novel. in which he made two really interesting points, were interesting to me. One was that the generation became writers as a result of the GI Bill. Therefore, they didn't have to become washing machine salesmen, as Vonnegut said. And the second was he averred that they tapped into the same confessional tradition as the poetry of that era. Is that something you would agree with?
I would agree with the first part. I think the GI Bill was hugely influential in shaping American culture after the war. I mean, I know Pete Hamill, a novelist who works in a vein very similar to Doctorow and who also, I think, is insufficiently appreciated on both sides of the Atlantic, went to Mexico to become an art student after serving in the U.S. military, and it was the GI Bill that saved him from following his father into the clock factory. So, you know, it's a story that you hear again and again.
And this ties in with your point about the way that people finance their careers, Anne-Marie.
Yes, I think there's a lot of private wealth. Poetry Foundation in Chicago, for instance, got a huge amount of money from Ruth Lilly, who made it in the pharmaceutical industry, and she has supported writers, poets and novelists for a number of years before her death.
So this money does still exist. There is still a bounty that
yes, there's money for the universities
will finance the new
and
generation.
Money for individuals. It's the old patronage thing. People can live if they have someone who's going to look after them, give them somewhere to write and money to live on.
Now, the second point he makes about confessional, I think it's slightly more contentious. Clearly, Plath and Anne Sexton and people in poetry were writing very confessionally. Are the novelists, the big male novelists, writing confessionally in the same way?
I think there are some. Who leaps to mind? Harold Brodkey, the novelist, tells us more about his sex life than I ever wanted to know.
Surely Roth does as well.
No, I think Roth is very different because in Roth's case, what you have is an elaborate and very carefully controlled strategy of concealment and revelation so that he appears to be writing about himself. Certainly his character is sometimes Philip Roth and sometimes Nathan Zuckerman, who looks a lot like Philip Roth. But, you know, except for Patrimony, all of his books transmute the experience of his own life into art. And I'm sure if you asked him, he would probably put it differently, but certainly would deny that
the confessional. Claire Bloom wouldn't think that, would she?
Yeah, in one particular novel in which there's an actress called Claire and the male character is having sex every afternoon while she's out.
And that's his wife.
He was married to Claire Bloom, and certainly she has written about her 17 years with Roth and how he used every bit of material about their lives. Okay. Very thinly disguised.
But again, there is a difference between using the material about one's life and writing something that's autobiographical or confessional.
Yes, and saying how James Joyce actually feel. Yeah.
Quote or anecdote, I suppose it is, about suggesting to his wife that she go out and sleep with someone else so that he could know what it felt like to be a cuckold. But he doesn't, you know, so you could say in that case he's making his life into his work. But that's very different from then writing about that life in a confessional way, in the way that W.D. Snodgrass, who was sort of the first confessional poet, did in Heart's Needle when he writes very intimately about his divorce. And Roth definitely isn't doing that. He's taking quite a different path with it. He's transforming his life into fiction.
Also, you know, you didn't ask the question, but it is, I think, an interesting question whether fiction travels.
I was just about to come to that.
I didn't mean to jump the gun, but
It certainly does travel in this direction. We're totally dominated by the big Americans, aren't we? But does it travel in the other direction?
You're dominated in some sense, but I would argue that you don't always get it right. That you overrate people who don't deserve
such
to
as
Bellow. I think Bellow is vastly overrated here. I mean, he's a great writer, but he's not the great writer. I think, on the other hand,
Saul Bellow.
Yeah, and I think on the other hand, because his politics are so uncongenial, his sexual politics, and because he was so uppity, Mailer is underrated here, even more scandalously than Bellow.
Do you agree with that, Norman Mailer and Bellow? I mean, Bellow's a bit of eclipse over here even, isn't he?
He is. It's interesting. What I think is interesting about Bellow currently is that up until his death, we were very, very interested in the UK. And when he died, we were very, very interested. And the time since his death, it seems to me that he has really disappeared in terms of the way that when we discuss American literature in the UK, we don't mention him in the way that we did before he died. And that is interesting to me because it seems to go both ways with novelists, that sort of thing.
And is that happening with Mailer as well?
Actually, no, I'd say. I think Mailer, quite the opposite. Yeah, he's coming back.
That's
we're more interested in him again.
What about the traffic in the opposite direction. Who are the British writers who might be more highly rated over than here?
I think people are still keen to read Ian McEwan in the United States. I also think that, you know, we could have had this discussion about poetry, but it depends on what you consider British. I mean, I don't think there's any writer who's more highly rated on either side. You know, I mean, I think Salman Rushdie is considered a great writer, and whether he's considered a great British writer or not in America, I think he is. Zadie Smith is read and loved in America, as she deserves to be.
We've just actually today had some quite extraordinary news from Hilary Mantel's agent. Wolf Hall sold 200,000 hardback copies in the US alone, and the total for the UK was 215,000 hardbacks. That makes it the seventh highest selling hardback novel of any kind for the first decade of the new millennium.
That's interesting. I mean, but it's not that surprising. If you go back a year and you look at the New York Times bestseller list, Sarah Dunant's novel was number 6. So, you know, we like historical fiction in America.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to leave that there for the moment. Thanks to Anne-Marie and Don. We're turning now to a novelist whose name conjures visions of those perfect English summers we so rarely have. She's Rose Tremain. Sarah Crowns spoke to her about her new novel, Trespass. She started by asking, what came first, the title or the concept of trespassing?
Definitely the idea, because the title came quite late and I played around with other titles. I mean, I suppose the idea that I started with was looking at sort of the problems of getting older. All the four protagonists in this book are in their 60s, and there's some sense in which they feel their lives to be over. And the book is an exploration of the way death is kind of trespassing on their lives. And their need at this late stage to make some accommodation with the past. Of course, the title applies really well to that and in other senses too. So it was a bit of a find, that title.
Mm. And so much of the book is about this area of France, the Cévennes, and your descriptions of it sort of anchor the whole text, really, and the weight at the centre of the book. Is this a landscape that you're really familiar with? Because it felt like it, reading it.
I was taken there even as a child when I was about, 10, 11, we were taken camping there. I went on one of my honeymoons there, and actually on day one our car was broken into and I lost all my luggage, which was, you know, we literally didn't even have a toothbrush. It was a great way to start a marriage. It was interesting, that event, because I suppose in that one thing that happened, it made me realise that in this very, very beautiful surrounding, so because it is an exceptionally beautiful place, the unexpected can suddenly come in a violent way. And this is exactly what happens in this book. So it's a landscape that has always presented itself to me as very extreme.
Yes, because it does that thing of you say Brits in France and you think you're in Provence, that sort of, you know, the romanticised idea, the bourgeois notion of going over to France and having a second home or, you know, moving there. And this book really, I felt, was playing with that idea a lot. I don't know whether consciously or not, but, you know, turning it on its head, the much darker underside, the fact that you're trespassing, again, to come back to that word, on a very fundamental level.
Yes, I think that some people who make this step into living abroad don't understand significantly enough what they're doing. I think that even sort of quite temporary exile from one's own culture is complicated. And I think people go, not just to France, but to Spain, various other places where Brits go. They go expecting it to fulfil needs that they don't get here. And then actually what they find is that perhaps those needs are fulfilled, but other problems arise, problems of language, problems of not understanding the culture, not understanding the landscape. My protagonist, Anthony, feels that this might be the salvation to a life which he is really just clinging onto by his fingertips. So he is, in a sense, he's naive. He goes into a place that he finds very beautiful, but he doesn't know anything about it. And this is the problem of this kind of displacement, isn't it? That you don't know enough.
And yet you have Anthony's sister, Veronica, and her partner, Kitty, who live out also in France, and he comes out to visit them. But then one of my favourite moments in the book was with Kitty, who's a watercolourist, but only of slight talent. And she's trying, you know, over and again, painting this landscape and not quite getting it right and being dissatisfied with her attempts and with what she's producing. And I wondered whether, as a sort of a landscape artist yourself, particularly in this book, you know, although obviously it's a different medium, whether she was representing you at all there, I suppose, and this idea of striving for something that you never, it's so perfect that you can't achieve that level of perfection.
Well, it's a very, very astute question. I mean, I hadn't thought of it quite in those terms. But yes, the idea that a stranger like me can go in and know enough about the place to write about it with any authenticity, it's obviously a question which I asked myself over and over again. I mean, not just in this book, because in most of my other books, I'm often in landscapes that I don't innately know. And this question of whether I have a kind of entitlement to write about them is often there at the beginning. And then what happens is the more I get into my story, into the recreation of something, the more confident I seem to become.
In your book, The Road Home, that's set in London. It's about sort of emigration rather than immigration, I suppose. But although the setting is different, ostensibly the book is very different, the subject matter is different, I felt that there were underlying things that sort of resonated between the two books, and this idea of displacement, I suppose, of not being at home in the place where you are and of trying to find a home in the place where you end up. And is this something that interests you? Because looking back through all of the books that you've written, it seems to me to be something that comes up again.
I think it's a very good point you make, and until people point out things like this, I don't notice them really. I think that every book is absolutely unique and different, and I'm embarking on something entirely new, and probably by the end of my writing life people will point out that actually I've just written the same book over and over again, and it's really all about exile and people searching for a home. And I think there are connections here. It's a different kind of search at a different point in these people's lives. Lev in The Road Home, I mean, he's coming with almost nothing. He's coming as a broken-hearted man who's lost his adored wife, and with all hope back home pinned on his ability to survive here and make money. As soon as he arrives here, that hope starts to spring. And I think the thing which is absorbing for the reader in that book is this fragile hope which is engendered by people being kind to him and helping him. Whereas, as you point out, in Trespass, Anthony Veery is travelling the other way. But what I wanted for him, really, particularly given the things that happened to him, is that he is in some senses sleepwalking towards his own death, whereas Lev in The Road Home is really, really hoping for a kind of restart of his life.
And another difference, or a way in which that difference is really thrown into relief, is the absence of children in this book. Apart from you have there's a sort of framing device for child at the very beginning and the very end of
yes.
the book.
Very significant. That was there absolutely from the beginning. We're talking about two sets of siblings, one French and one British, and there are no children from either, from any of these four people, and therefore in a certain sense no future. And I think it's Veronica, Anthony's sister at one point, who says it wouldn't have mattered whether it had been my child or Anthony's child, but there should have been a child, someone that we could love and whom we could pass these things.
Yeah, the closest that it comes is when Kitty, Veronica's partner, sends her a postcard of her holding a baby koala.
I know. Somebody was saying to me about this book, she said the other day, that's the image which upset me the most, that the fact that Kitty sends this postcard of herself in Australia hugging a koala bear, saying, and that the caption is, at least somebody loves me.
The eminently lovable Rose Tremaine talking there to Sarah Crown. Trespass is published by Chatto and Windus. And that's it for today's podcast. Thanks to Anne-Marie Fife, Didi Guttenplan, Rose Tremaine and Sarah Crown. You can see the Troubadour Poetry Programme on coffeehousepoetry.org, and there will be more of the poetry discussion in the autumn edition of Poetry London. In the Guardian Saturday Review this week, Philip Pullman rewrites The Life of Jesus. We also profile the American writer Michael Chabon. On Sunday, The Observer sets off on the trail of the writer Tim Guest, author of the commune memoir My Life in Orange, who died suddenly last year at just 34 years old. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Claire Armistead, and the producer is Scott Corley. Until next week, goodbye.